I mean, obviously, there's a intense flurry of diplomatic activity happening. And in the media outlets that are preferred by the Trump administration, like Axios, they're really pushing this idea that the U.S. and Iran are on the verge of signing a one-page memorandum of understanding that wouldn't be a comprehensive deal, but that would stop the acute phase of the war and then provide a framework for a range of negotiations, beginning with an opening of the strait, some form of a non-aggression agreement that Iran would want to apply to all of its regional allies. But this is the U.S. version of the story. And there's sort of a pattern that we're watching unfold here, which is that the U.S. and Iran have been indirectly negotiating primarily through the mediator country of Pakistan. And what they've been doing is exchanging amendments to a 14-point framework that they've been discussing. And what happens is that when the Iranians submit their amendments to it, Donald Trump begins posting things on Truth Social, and then leaks begin to Axios and other news outlets, and they try to create a momentum that is intended on putting pressure on Iran and making it look like the U.S. is being reasonable, Iran is being obstructionist. In reality, the U.S. consistently injects into this framework maximalist demands. Trump has claimed that he wants to get an unconditional surrender of Iran. When the Iranians respond to Trump, they denounce the Iranians. And then Trump goes online and he threatens to bomb their civilization or to carry out another bombing campaign that's going to be more intense than the last one, which was the case of what he did on Wednesday morning after these reports started that there was going to be some kind of a deal. You know, I talk a lot to Iranian sources, including Iranian officials. And the top line that I think is important to emphasize from the Iranian perspective is that they are very quick to remind anyone that twice in a single year, the United States claimed to be negotiating with Iran only to turn around and conduct massive bombing of Iran, even when there was another round of negotiations scheduled on the books. That happened in June of 2025 when the U.S. and Israel initiated the so-called 12-day war. And it started on February 28th when the U.S. and Israel launched a massive bombing campaign against Iran that went on for many weeks. The wild card here that the Trump administration seems to have genuinely been taken aback by and shocked by is that Iran didn't fold. Iran didn't capitulate. So the status right now is part of a pattern where the U.S., because Trump is desperate for an off-ramp, is trying to force through a deal. What we don't know is what concessions the Iranians might be willing to make. It's clear that the Trump administration already is making concessions. They announced this as a regime change war. They said they want unconditional surrender. That hasn't happened. And the Iranians have shown that that is not going to happen. So where things stand right now is it's highly possible that Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu are going to resume the bombing of Iran, that they may do another round of assassinations of Iranian leaders. That's always a possibility. It's also possible that we're heading toward a deal that Trump is going to try to spin as a victory, as though he should be praised for putting out small portions of the massive, intense fires that he himself started. And so what we're looking at right now is a situation where the Iranians say that they are fully engaged in the diplomatic track, that they are doing indirect negotiations. They say they won't do direct talks until the United States formally lifts the blockade on the Strait of Hormuz. They are sending amendments back and forth with the United States, but they say that they have their own red lines. They want any ceasefire or non-aggression pact to apply to all regional allies. Israel is engaged in massive bombing of southern Lebanon right now. It continues to engage in intense ground operations. Hezbollah, which the Israelis claimed was basically wiped out, has been ferociously fighting back Israeli attempts to conquer or take more of Lebanese territory.
All right, so that's a little update from about 2 hours ago from Drop Site News about the latest in the negotiations with Iran. I got to be honest, I don't know what to make, how to make heads or tails of this. You got Rubio, Marco Rubio, giving this long press conference couple days ago about the attacks on Iran, but it's like everything is topsy-turvy. You hear completely different messaging from the same people within 24 hours. So luckily, we're going to be joined in the next segment by Brandon Weikert. He's going to help us hopefully make sense of the nonsense of the Iran war and where it goes from here and what possible off-ramps could still be taken to try to minimize the already significant damage to the world. Stay with us. It's the War Room Live on Alex Jones Network. We'll be right back.
We've been right about the poison shots and raised the main alarm, and right about the open borders, and right about the wars, and right about the entire agenda. That's why the bad guys want us off air. And that's why it's such a revolutionary act when you take the live feed from Real Alex Jones on X or on Rumble at AJN Live. Get the free app for your phone at alexjonesapp.com. When you support us, we are absolutely unstoppable. All of our victories are shared together. It's because of you. Take action now at realalexjones.com and thealexjonesstore.com. Do you think I'm going to sell you something that doesn't really work? I always ask people, they never know the answer. Even salesmen, I go, who's the best salesman? The best salesman, a smart salesman, goes and finds what is the hottest, best product that's in demand. It sells itself. I promote freedom. I promote liberty. You are insane if you don't get our Ultra Methylene Blue, the very best out there. You're insane if you don't get our Methylene Red. You're crazy if you don't do bovine colostrum. You're crazy if you don't take these products. They really work and they fund the operation.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is War Room Live. I'm your host, Harrison Smith. We're going to talk about the Iran war this hour. I'm very happy to be joined by my guest, Brandon Weikert. He's a geopolitical analyst and the author of Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower, as well as a number of other incredible books. He also manages the Weikert Report, World News Done Right. You can follow him on X at WeTheBrandon and WeikertReport.com. And of course, he's been a regular fixture on alternative right-wing media since, for a while, but certainly since the Iran war began, providing really unparalleled analysis of what's going on in Iran. And I haven't found a single, I've been watching you this whole time, and I haven't found a single thing that you've been wrong about or disagreed with you about. You might be the only person in America I feel that way about. So, you know,
well,
so
thank you.
You're
very kind.
Well,
yes, I've taken a lot of incoming and I will continue to, I'm sure, but the truth must be spoken.
Yeah. And it seems hard to grasp at this point. What is the truth? Where are we? What's going on? I mean, I try to keep up with this stuff. I think I get a handle on it. And then there's some announcement from Marco Rubio that contradicts Donald Trump or from Iran that contradicts America. And it's like, at a certain point, I kind of throw my hands up and go, Brandon will figure it out and he'll tell me what's going on. So what is going on? What's the latest with Iran? How's the war going, man?
Well, the war is going about as well as the last time you and I spoke, which is we're very proficient at blowing things up and, harassing the Iranians, and they are very proficient at doing the same to us. So in essence, it's kind of a stalemate, but the longer the war goes on, as I told you before, the more it favors Iran because, frankly, they're not as exposed to the global, instability of prices related to shortages in the oil and natural gas market, the helium market, et cetera, et cetera. They are one of the most sanctioned countries in the world. So they can kind of sit down and wait for us to lose our momentum, which we are, as long as they hold out and survive, which they will, they win by default. And this is something that the president and his team clearly did not understand when they got into it. And it's interesting you brought up all the different sort of narratives coming out of the same administration. I mean, sometimes the president himself is negating something he just said an hour earlier in the day.
Right.
Part of me thinks that's by design, just to make everybody so confused and tired, they just stop asking questions and kind of go with the flow. But then part of me thinks that it shows you how unprepared for this conflict the administration was. And it is my contention that not only are they desperately looking for a way out, but they're trying to find a way out that allows the administration to look like they still have the upper hand, which is why I believe hostilities are getting ready to commence again, irrespective of what's going on with these talks in Pakistan or through Pakistan. I think that's all a feint. We've seen this before where the administration uses diplomacy as a feint to basically buy time until they're ready to strike again.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is that you've got all of these signals coming at once, right? You've got, movement of troops towards the Middle East. You've got a lot of signals. If you're paying attention, it's like, oh, it looks like we're getting ready for a big attack. And then you read headlines. It's like, oh, Trump is asking his military advisors about declaring victory and walking away. Now, obviously, I tend to go from more of the what's physically happening on the ground, not what are they spreading in right. the media. But still, it's just this disconnection, this total, I don't know, the rootlessness. I don't know what to call it, because there's just nothing to sink your teeth into and go, okay, here's what's happening. However, there has been some things revealed recently that you were right about on my show and I was right about, saying I think the damage that Iran has done to American bases is greater than they're telling us. Yeah. And that has now been revealed. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. So basically, you and I were sort of at the forefront of declaring that. And at least in my case, I got a lot of hate mail, a lot of threats online from these weird bot accounts, which clearly are connected to the U.S. government. Harassment campaign for about 3 weeks I was subjected to online. Basically, though, the U.S. military has spent many decades, hundreds of billions of dollars, building up a handful of very key forward deployed bases throughout the Middle East. And in about 72 hours of the war having begun, the Iranians effectively destroyed or significantly damaged those bases to the point that they are no longer able to be used. That we basically have spent all this money and time building those facilities up over decades, and they were basically erased from being used, being effective in about 3 days. And that indicates, or that should indicate to your audience, how significant the Iranian missile, the ballistic missile threat was. In fact, the Iranian ballistic missile threat is so significant that the U.S. intelligence community in the last week or so has had to publicly admit and change the declarations of Secretary of Defense or War, Pollyanna Pete Hegseth. Originally, he said we had gotten 70-80% of their missile launchers and that we had destroyed most of their underground missile cities. Now the intelligence community is coming out and saying, no, we got maybe 50% at best of those missiles. So the Iranians, and they're still churning these things out in the underground missile cities. So the Iranians are still combat effective, and they are very combat effective to the point that they have denied us use of several key bases, including the all-important U.S. Navy headquarters for the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain, which has basically been wiped off the face of the earth. And you've got U.S. naval personnel having to take shelter in the Hilton, being targeted there because, of course, the locals are saying, hey, the Americans are in the Hilton, take it right. out, Iran, because most of the people in Bahrain are Shiite Muslims, which is the majority religion in Iran. So anyway, it is a complete degradation of the U.S. strategic position in the region, and it will end, I think, with the local governments most of those local governments, the Arab states, not having us come back in a meaningful way to rebuild those bases, because clearly it makes them more of a target than it does protect them.
Yeah, and this is kind of the thing, and we'll get into it now. I sort of wanted to start with the details and expand out, but let's just expand out right now, because and we'll talk about the ceasefire, and we'll talk about, you know, the shortages and starvation mm-hmm. and stuff. But it seems to me like what is happening with the war in Iran is going to fundamentally change the world and the way America interacts with the world. It yeah. seems like it's been revealed now that there's always this idea of all of these bases we have over the world are necessary for national security. And what is being revealed through the war with Iran is these bases are a liability for us. They really don't help. They're not capable of you know, projecting power in the way that we said. Obviously, you've got the Gulf countries going, we thought this was an agreement. We gave you things. You gave us security. You can't give us security. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is going to rearrange, like, it really is going to destroy the world order as it exists now, right? And may cause the military to rethink this whole idea of having a thousand yeah. bases everywhere in the world. I mean, can you talk about that? Just sort of the large scale yeah. future changes this is going to bring about in just like geopolitical calculus.
Well, undoubtedly, it's more evidence of that, which I've been saying for over, you know, many, almost a decade now, that the U.S. unipolar post-Cold War order is over. It was dying 10 years ago. It's dead now. It's sort of a zombie empire now that we've got here. But eventually the zombie will be put down. And it's sad that's happening in the Middle East. So even if somehow Trump was able to, you know, reopen the Strait of Hormuz tomorrow, even if suddenly the regime in Iran were to go away, the fact of the matter is that those bases, those key areas for us, have been denied to us. And given the economic and political fallout that's still yet to happen in the Arab states that hosted those bases, the probability that we will be asked to come back in the same capacity that we were there before the war is very low. In fact, as the war continues, as the shortages continue, particularly in the Middle East, in those Arab states, I believe that at least a handful, maybe one or two at least, of those Arab states will be those governments, those pro-American governments, will be overthrown by at least American skeptical governments, which will not want to see us come back. And what you're seeing, Harrison, you're right to point this out. We now have viable proof that the presence of U.S. bases in all of these territories is not a deterrence. It is a compellent toward war.
Right.
It's the fuel on the fire that is war. And for a very long time, U.S. policymakers in D.C. have sold themselves and the American people on this notion that we need those bases because they prevent they keep small wars from becoming large wars. And what we're finding is just the opposite now. So my hope is that the silver lining, Harrison, in this is that the troops will come home now. There's no choice because there's nowhere for them to stay anymore. And so hopefully we can reorient and kind of come back home and rebuild ourselves. But the pathway there is going to be very long and hard and humiliating now. This is a humiliation of Uncle Sam and a really bad moment in our history.
Well, but as you point out, I mean, it's like, okay, if we learn the lesson from this that all these bases are just draining our resource and not actually providing security. Like you said, I mean, this is what we've wanted. And I think we even joked about it early on in the Iran war of going, hey, Trump could, you know, say, okay, you know, we're done. We're withdrawing from the Middle East and, you know, actually sort of most effectively get out of the Middle East by just leaving the trash behind. It's
this
like,
this could be, yes,
that'd be great.
This
that'd
could
be great.
Very big for us. Yeah, you know, it could. It's just unfortunate that, you know, I've been saying this for a while. It's just like Afghanistan. I wanted us out of Afghanistan for years, but how you get out is very important because you don't want to be seen as being thrown out and the locals, you know, pelting your rear end with, tomatoes on the way out. This is not a way to exit anything. But that's what's happening in the Middle East. So that what that image will do will to basically empower American rivals globally who will then say not only is Uncle Sam leaving and down and out, but this is clear that he's now effectively a useless entity and we are now going to rise to replace him, which again, I that's going to happen anyway, but it just the way it's happening is very unfortunate. This is entirely a disaster of our own making in the Middle East. None of this was necessary.
Absolutely. And now, you know, with almost supreme comedy, Marco Rubio's out there giving speeches where he says the goal of this war is to basically correct the problems that were created by this war. I mean, I think humiliation's already been achieved. At this point, it's like it's just piling on. We've already been humiliated. Am I right? I mean, trying to put a good face on this, but like, I don't think anybody's buying it.
Well, and anytime they try to put a good face on it, because they can't read, none of them are reading from the same song sheet.
Right.
They're all saying different things. So it's actually just creating a bigger humiliation exercise or ritual for us to endure. This to me is a lot, you know, Alex Jones talks a lot about the problem, reaction, solution cycle.
Yep.
This is sort of like that, where the problem of the Strait of Hormuz, it's entirely of our own making. February 28th is when this all started. So Trump created the problem and now he's going to try to resolve it by reopening the strait, which I think is, it is darkly comedic. It's just unfortunate that we have so many of our people in harm's way because of this.
Yeah, maybe it's not funny, but it's certainly ironic. It's certainly, not what you would expect from a superpower like us and all of the strength that we, you know,
and I don't think we can even call ourselves a superpower anymore. And then that was the subtitle of my first book. And I've often joked I need to change it now because clearly America is a superpower no more.
That's the question. Now people are saying Iran has proven it's a superpower. I mean, it can stand up and go toe to toe. I mean,
for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's for sure. And that's part of the rejiggering of the global environment, which is leading to, I mean, right now we've gone from a unipolar world system dominated by the U.S. unquestionably to a unstable tripolar system of the U.S., Russia, and China. And it's clearly trending now toward a truly multipolar system in which the United States will be one of many great powers. And I would argue, unless we do something significant to change things here at home, which I don't think will happen, we are a declining power of all those great powers. And this is not a good position to be in if you're the United States.
Well, and especially if you're a fan of the, you know, United States imperial strategy. And I was just scrolling because I wanted to give credit to Josiah Lippincott. He just posted a great podcast where he's talking. And so I'm sort of stealing his idea. So I want to give him credit because I just watched his video last night. And it was so brilliant because he was talking about how these bases are a liability and how the way that's justified is to say, well, we need them there because the trade uplifts the dollar and we depend on the dollar being the world reserve currency. But even if you sort of play that out to its logical end, it's like, well, is this really beneficial to America? Is having the dollar as the world reserve currency benefit us at all? It requires us to have all this military expenditure. That's all money that has to be taken out of the American taxpayer. You know, maybe at the end of this, this really is, it's sort of stinks how we had to get there. But at the end of this, this could be the death of the American empire. And maybe we can become a republic again. Maybe we could focus on the problems here at home if we're not being distracted by being the world policeman. I mean, do you think there's a positive outcome in reality for actual Americans out of this?
Their hope is always there, especially because we are blessed by our geographical isolation, and distance from Eurasia and the Middle East. It's not like these countries are right next door, although we are doing a bang up job of importing all these people. That's another issue though. But no, that is always a hope that this will end up somewhere positive. I would also say though, if you were interested in the world reserve, the dollar being the world reserve currency, actually, this militarism has not actually shored that up. It's actually weakened that as well, because a lot of people now are looking for alternatives, particularly the Chinese and others, specifically because of the militarism of the U.S. Abroad. And so even the argument that the bases and the sort of freedom of navigation operations are key for ensuring the U.S. reserve currency, I actually don't think that that holds up anymore. Under scrutiny, because clearly we are actually helping to create our own rivals, not only through global trade, but through our own actions where we engage militarily. And then the rest of the world goes, you know what? I don't want to live under this empire. I want something else. I want more options.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, you know, not only do we not need to be the world policeman, but we have all the prosperity and, you know, the bounty of nature here at home. We got plenty of materials here. Why we need to steal them from other, you know, countries? It's just absurd. And the whole idea of empires is supposed to actually benefit the empire, but instead we're spending endlessly to maintain this thing that really doesn't benefit us at all. It's again, it's like it's this sort of the inevitable consequence. You know, you called it a zombie empire. I think that's accurate. I mean, how long do you think we've been zombified? Or is this a new development with the Iran war? Or have we been sleepwalking into this for a long time?
I think we've been sleepwalking. I think the beginning of the end began with the deindustrialization craze of the 1970s. Right. And I think it kind of went into hyperdrive by 2003 with the invasion of Iraq. And now everything you're seeing is just sort of the inevitable natural end point or end state of those actions. And it's, you know, it's going to be painful and brutal for not just us, but the rest of the world, as we're seeing in the Middle East. But ultimately, I do believe this is going to end with a multipolar world. There will probably be a major great power conflict between the arrival of that multipolar system and where we're at now. But I think at the end of this thing is going to be basically a great flattening and a great equalization among many poles of power in the world system.
Here we go. This is some breaking news crews bringing up. Netanyahu convenes security cabinet, says he will speak to Trump tonight about Iran developments. We've seen headlines saying Netanyahu's very angry about the prospect of peace, which I feel like I've seen that headline a bunch. Anytime we get close to solving things with Iran, it's like Netanyahu gets pissed. And just the idea of being angry
Netanyahu's
at peace.
Netanyahu's doing his wellness check. He's doing a wellness check on Trump. That's what he's doing. So.
Well, we need to do a wellness check on him. I mean, apparently he's got 10 different types of cancer. He may have died in an airstrike against Iran 2 months ago. I mean, we don't even know.
He might be a zombie. I mean, we don't know.
We really don't. But how, I mean, how, you know, the fear of peace, how real is that fear? How real is the idea, do you think, that the talks that are either happening now or going to happen now? Again, I can't get a handle on this stuff, but apparently there's some sort of rapprochement happening, some sort of discussion going on. How likely do you think it is that in a month from now, this whole thing is in the rearview mirror?
Oh, I think that this thing's just getting started. I think that Netanyahu knows this is a bunch of, you know, posturing by Trump. I think ultimately for Netanyahu, peace is the death knell of him, his prime ministership, but it's also the end of possibly his legal freedom. I mean, people don't remember this, but he has been under legal investigation, not just for failures related to 10-7, but for longstanding corruption charges. And about 2 weeks ago, when the Israeli Supreme Court convened for the first time in forever, the first case they took up was to reopen the corruption investigation into Netanyahu. Trump, about a week ago, called Herzog, the president of Israel, and demanded that he give Netanyahu a pardon. And Herzog said under no circumstance will he ever grant a pardon for Netanyahu. So the longer the war lasts, the greater the power is for Netanyahu, and the less likely it is that he will be taken down by the Israeli legal system. So that is also one of the perverse incentives behind Netanyahu. You know, people say it's about greater Israel, and I do think that that's an ideological imperative of the Likud party generally, but I actually think it's baser than that for Netanyahu. I think this is just his get out of jail free card. He doesn't want to have to deal with whatever criminal activity he was engaged in, the ramifications of that. So the more he fights and the wider the war becomes, the less likely it is he's going to have to pay the price.
You know, you saying that just and, you know, maybe I'm giving too much credit to Trump here, but it kind of makes sense that he wants the pardon for Benjamin Netanyahu. So he can be like, look, if you're not trying to put him in jail, maybe this war will end. I mean, I've sort of considered that before, but when you said it, it actually made a lot of sense. And he's like, please pardon Netanyahu so Netanyahu will stop bombing Lebanon and we can get a ceasefire. I mean, that could very well be a strategy.
Maybe it is, but then again, you have to also remember the ideological imperative is still there. Netanyahu's party very badly wants to, at the very least, create a security, you know, cordon in southern Lebanon. Interestingly enough, though, Harrison, the IDF is not performing well against Hezbollah. And the very interesting thing here is that the Hezbollah units that are fighting Israel are a reduced detachment. They are not part of the sort of elite cadre of Hezbollah. Those guys were moved out after the pager operation, and those guys were put in the northern part of Lebanon to better protect them. So what the Golani Brigade is fighting are not the best of the Hezbollah fighters, and yet Hezbollah has been running circles around the Golani Brigade, which indicates to me how depleted these Israeli defense forces are. They need a deal even more than we do, I think.
Well, and of course, that's sort of always been the case, right? I mean, the IDF has never gone toe-to-toe with Hezbollah with any success, really.
Fair enough.
Now, Hezbollah has come is adapting strategies out of the Ukraine war. They're now using fiber optic drones, and the Israelis apparently have not learned lessons from Ukraine and have no ability to defend against this. So, it's still very much up in the air where this goes. And the crew just pulled up the headline, and I've got it here as well. As Murtaza Hussein says, right on schedule with reported U.S.-Iran talks, Israel initiates bombing of Beirut to sabotage the possible end to the war. I mean, it's uncanny,
isn't it? We've
always
been at war.
It's uncanny. Every time Netanyahu goes to court, there's an emergency. Every time we're about to get peace with Iran, they bomb Lebanon. It's almost like it's not even a coincidence at all. We'll be right back on the other side. Brandon Weikert is my guest. Follow him on X at WeTheBrandon. We'll be right back.
I have been very blessed and honored in 32 years on air and 28 years of InfoWars to have seen the whole world change. When I first got started, almost nobody knew about the globalists. People were literally in the dark. Look how far we've come. We are exposing them. Jeffrey Epstein, the pedophile rings, the poison COVID shots, the open borders, the global wars, the 5G, all of it is coming out. Humanity is rallying. This is the fourth turning. This is the Great Awakening. It is the answer to their Great Reset. I am so proud of humanity, and I'm so thankful to all the viewers and listeners who over the years have supported us by prayer, word of mouth, and financial support at thealexjonesshow.com. So InfoWars has been shut down, but we've launched the Alex Jones Network. We plan to crank this sucker up. We got new studios, they're even bigger, being built. And we want to go 19 hours a day live by the end of 2026 from 5 a.m. until midnight. So if I build it, will you come? Yes, I know you will. So now more than ever, go to thealexjonesshow.com and get incredible supplements. Our methylene blue is the best. Our methylene red is proprietary. Our bovine colostrum, the widest selection of Patriot Apparel, incredible collectible knives, and so much more. You are literally financing the tip of the spear and the resistance that the tyrants and the globalists hate above everything else. InfoWars is a proven winner. They have a URL. They have an old studio. That means nothing. You are the InfoWar. And if you accept this mission, if you take action, if you spread the word, if you share our links, alexjoneslive.com, the news site, the live feeds, the articles, the videos, it's incredible. If you share the feed with everybody you know at alexjonesapp.com, get the free Droid or Apple download of the app, it is insane. All the power lies with you. That's why when callers call in and thank me, I say, thank me. I would fight this no matter what. I'd fight it in a ditch. I'd fight if I was homeless. We're all in this together. You have all the power, but you have to use the power now. Share the feeds to alexjoneslive.com. Share the URL, alexjonesapp.com. And go to thealexjonesshow.com with the widest selection of Patriot apparel to wear your uniform of liberty openly and proudly. It's such an adventure to wear this apparel and to get the incredible supplements that will empower your life so you'll know how real this is. I only sell stuff that really works, so I want you to get it and take it and love it and have a great response. We have a 90+% reorder rate. So many of you are on the fence. Take action now. Step into a wider world. Go to thealexjonesshow.com today and support this broadcast. But regardless, take the feed, take the live links at alexjoneslive.com/show and on Rumble and Relox Shows on X, the Alex Jones Show on Rumble, and share those links, and it changes the world. You are unstoppable when you decide to get up at the plate and take action. This is real. This isn't hype. You've seen the results. Now the ball's in your court. AlexJonesLive.com and AlexJonesApp.com. Take action. You are the reincarnation of Paul Revere. You are unstoppable. The globalists are in deep crap. Take action now at AlexJonesLive.com and AlexJonesApp.com. And I want to be clear. I don't own the AlexJonesStore.com. Bigly, that owns the Alex Jones Network, does. We've got a major deal with Rumble to push our information. It's already top on Rumble, but to supercharge it. The most important coordinate in this fight is rumble.com/Alex Jones Live. rumble.com/Alex Jones Live. We are already at the top of Rumble, but we're going to go even further partnering with them. This is the coordinates of liberty. Take action right now at rumble.com/Alex Jones Live, and we are unstoppable. The power of humanity is unstoppable if you simply unleash it now.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
Joining me this hour, yeah, sorry, we got a little technical difficulties here. My button's messed up again. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is War Room Live. However you're watching us, congratulations on circumventing the censorship and finding the forbidden outlet, the Alex Jones Network. Please do share those links on X, on Facebook, on your text messages, however you can. Let people know where to find us at AJN Live, Alex Jones Live on Rumble, and of course, follow me at Harrison H. Smith, and you can follow my guest, Brandon Weikert, at We The Brandon on X. And, you know, Brandon, I think the Iran war is going so bad they're about to introduce aliens. Like, I think if you really want to know how bad the Iran war is going, they're about to do alien disclosure. I think that tells you everything you need to know.
Better be careful, because Epstein's probably in those files too. So
Uh-oh. No, but I mean, all of this stuff is so insane. I can't help but seeing a connection between these. But I want to get your response to some of the things, some of the statements made by Marco Rubio yesterday. Clip 25 here. If we can go to clip 25, this is Marco Rubio saying what the new end to the goal of the war is. And I mean, it's just cartoonish. It would be funny if this wasn't a war with people dying and the end of the world possibly, you know, in the offing. But let's go to clip 25 now.
As President Trump has said, and the facts clearly bear out, the United States of America holds all the cards. There is no scenario here in which if they decide to join a ladder of escalation, they wind up getting the last say. But our preference is for these straits to be opened to the way they're supposed to be opened, back to the way it was. Anyone can use it, no mines in the water, nobody paying tolls. That's what we have to get back to, and that's the goal here.
That's the goal here, back to the way it was, Brandon. I mean, just admit defeat. Like, that's what you're doing there is effectively admitting defeat.
Yeah, well, and it gets worse for us, unfortunately, because not only are they not going to admit defeat, but this morning, East Coast time at least, this morning, it was revealed that the Iranians have created an entirely new bureaucracy for basically running the so-called toll booth in the Strait of Hormuz. And so what that indicates to me, I think it's called the Iranian port, something, port authority or something. But basically that indicates to me that the Iranians are now not only saying we're in control now, but they're saying we are never going back to the way it was before. And while I definitely am not somebody who thinks you can rely on international law for a variety of reasons, it should be pointed out here, and I don't say this because I'm in favor of this, but this is just the way it is. It should be noted that there is a precedence for Iran doing what it's doing in the context of international law. There's the Montreux Convention, which governs Turkey's control over the, I think it's the, what is it, Turkish Strait or the Dardanelles that leads to, yeah. And so for 100 years since the Montreux Convention, they've basically charged ships transit fees, and they've managed what is inherently Turkish territorial waters through those straits. Even though it's classified as an international waterway, it falls completely within Turkish territorial waters. Same thing is true of the Strait of Hormuz. It falls within Iranian territorial waters, technically speaking. Now, the Iranians never asserted control, really, ever, over the strait, but now that is done. Those days are over, and we caused this situation by attacking the way we did when we did. So the Iranians are never letting go of this. And like you said, you know, Marco just looks like a clown. Our leadership looks buffoonish with them talking like this as if they're going to be able to change this. The only way they're going to change this is if they get regime change in Iran, and that is not on the table.
No, not even remotely on the table. No. And we did start it. Like, we started this. That's the crazy thing. And so for Iran, it's perfectly reasonable for them to say, look, we're not going to end this until we have real deterrence, until we really let everybody know you can't just bomb us at will and expect us to take it. We do have the capability to respond, and we will respond. I mean, I think they've already kind of proven that. How much longer do you think it needs to go until Iran feels that they've established that deterrence?
Well, it's not going to end until the United States reduces its physical presence in the region. So this is why. And in fact, actually, President Pezeshkian, who's the Iranian president, interestingly, he was raised among the Kurdish population of Iran. And I bring that up for a very specific reason that I hope we get to.
Right.
But ultimately, the Iranian president has made it very clear at the very beginning of the war. He told, I think it was the BBC or Al Jazeera, he said to them that we can't stop this war until the Americans know that they are not welcome to do this anymore. And the only way to do that is to make sure the Americans reduce their footprint in the region, which, of course, that gets back to what we were talking about before the break with the bases.
Sure.
So until the U.S. fully reduces its physical presence in the region, the hostilities will continue on some level. And I brought up the Kurdish issue because now we're hearing, and we've been hearing, the administration wants to covertly arm the Kurds of Iran. I would just point out that the Kurds of Iran are not the same as the Kurds of neighboring Iraq. The Kurds of neighboring Iraq hated Saddam. They hated the Ba'athist regime that we ultimately toppled. They were sort of these rebels. They had no problem taking up arms on our behalf against Baghdad in 2003. That is not the case with the Iranian Kurds. Many of the Iranian Kurds are integrated into the regime. They're part of the elite. As I said, the current president was raised among the Kurds of Iran. It's very different. And there's a lot of rumor that the CIA had attempted about a month and a half ago to arm the Kurds of Iran, and the Iranian Kurds took the guns and gave us the bird.
Right.
Obviously didn't overthrow the regime. So that's, you know, this is where we are, though, because the administration is so desperate, Harrison, yeah, to have regime change.
You took the word out of my mouth, desperation. It was a desperate act. And obviously it turned around on us. And when you bring up the Kurds, that makes me think of Turkey, because Turkey has, you know, long running anonymity or, enmity with the Kurds. How does Turkey play into this? What role do you think they play in whatever this new world order is going to be? And what role are they playing right now in terms of their relationship with Iran?
Well, it's interesting because the Turks have traditionally, under Erdogan, the current president, have had very positive relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. They've always gotten along. In 2013, they were involved with the gold for oil scandal, I think is what it was called. They've always been very close with the Iranians. But they've also, Erdogan, despite his rhetoric against Israel, Erdogan has always maintained very close ties with the Israeli government. Mm. In fact, the current scheme of moving Azerbaijani natural gas and oil out of Central Asia via pipelines through the Kurdish part of Iraq into places like Syria and to places like the Levant, this is a Turkish scheme that was concocted with the assistance of the Israelis and the U.S. So the Turks are playing this very unique middle game, which is the traditional role they play in the Middle East. Remember, Turkey is not ethnically Arab or Persian, and they tend to be Sunni Muslim, so they tend to be religiously more in line with the Arab states than with the Iranian state, but yet they still have positive relations with Iran. Ultimately, Harrison, I think that what you're going to witness, though, soon, with the way the Israelis are constantly attacking Turkey, I think you could very easily see something shape up where the Turks maybe are aligned with the Iranian Kurds and the Iran state, but they're still very much disliking the Kurds of Syria, for instance, because those guys are the ones that have problems with the Turkish state. So ultimately, I think you're seeing this very interesting interplay between Turkey, Israel, and Iran, where Turkey's playing this hedging role. But Israel could easily, and I think they're starting to, push Turkey away because Netanyahu's clearly trying to pick a fight with Turkey now, which, you know, is where we're at. So,
yeah. And of course, Turkey's a member of NATO. So that gets real complicated real fast. I mean, you'd want to talk about a tangled web. I'm just trying to visualize as you're talking, like, okay, these guys don't like these guys, but they're allies mm-hmm. with the, so they're friends with Iran, but not the Kurds, but yes, with the Iranian Kurds, and they're friends yep. with Israel, but also friends with Iran. I mean, it's a total yep. tangled web, and you know, Turkey does seem to thrive in that sort of situation where they can be friends yep. and enemies with everybody all the time. I mean, same thing with Russia and Turkey. I yep. mean, they have enmity and yet work together all the time. Turkey is a total wild card in all of this. How does this play out with NATO? Because I've seen the same signals that you have. The Iranians, or the Israelis rather, saying after Iran, Turkey will be next. We're seeing now sort of think pieces out of American outlets saying, you know, Turkey really shouldn't be in NATO. Maybe we should drive them out. I mean, they are clearly seeding the ground for the future narrative that Turkey is the new Iran, right? I mean, how does this play out with them right. being in NATO?
Well, one AEI fellow even wrote that the U.S. should leave NATO because Turkey's in NATO,
right.
which, of course, now you think, wow, that is really devious, because obviously that would appeal to the president, who is understandably wanted out of NATO. I've wanted out of NATO for many years, but how we get out is very important. And would we be getting out because it would be in our interest, which it would be in our interest to get out, or are we getting out because it would make it easier for Israel to start a fight with Turkey
right.
if the U.S. was no longer the centerpiece of NATO? And this is, you know, this is very complex here. I believe fundamentally that you are witnessing a generational shift in the Middle East. I think that no matter what, there will be a reduction in the power and potency of the U.S. as the kind of key shaper of events in the Middle East after this war. And I think ultimately you're going to see the rise of a new interplay, a new balance of power between the, to some degree, the Saudis in the Arab world, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Turkish sort of Islamic Republic, and then Israel sort of on the periphery still playing a role. But this new balance of power that's shaping up is not going to benefit either the United States or Israel, in my opinion, in the long run, because these powers recognize that Israel is kind of like a rabid dog right now. And even the countries in the Arab states that want to do business with Israel, look at what they're getting out of this. They're getting attacked by Iran, and they're not happy about it. So on some level, you're seeing a balancing act. And don't forget also the Pakistanis. Pakistanis are providing a security umbrella for Saudi Arabia. In fact, most of Saudi Arabia's armed forces are staffed by Pakistanis. They pay them better than the Pakistani army does. So, and now the Pakistanis are extending their nuclear umbrella to Saudi Arabia, allegedly. So the whole region is shifting, and it's going to be less American, more local, and it's definitely not going to be oriented toward Israel.
Yeah, and it just we're just setting ourselves up to be screwed over by any of this. Again, we didn't need to start the fight in the first place. We certainly didn't need to back Israel to the hilt in the way that we did. And it seems like this could have been an opportunity for America to become trade partners with some of these countries and sort of reform our relationship in a positive direction. And yet we're going the worst possible route. I mean, it is especially insane when you know that, I mean, unless things have changed, Turkey is still the home to our, like, nuclear stockpile in Europe, right? I mean,
we've got B-61 gravity bombs in Incirlik.
That's another twist to this. How do we, are we going to go to war with a country that has our nuclear weapons? I mean, it's crazy.
Well, the key thing is we have operational control over them, but obviously, if they really wanted to seal up the base, they could, the Turks could. And the Turks are a competent military. The Turks are not, the Iranians are a very competent unconventional force. The Turks are a very competent conventional force. So if I were Israel, I would not really want to be picking a fight with the Turks. And that if the Turks needed to put the squeeze on anybody in that region, they pretty well could, with no backup from us. They wouldn't need that. And in terms of, closing down our base there, I do know this is always a contingency that we have had to plan for, and I'm sure the Turks have planned for, is if they do try to take those nuclear weapons over, because ultimately it's in their country. Getting them out would be very hard. So this is sort of the nightmare scenario we're going down, and I hope it doesn't get to that. But ultimately, Turkey doesn't need nukes to be a very effective, military. They've proven that they're very effective, and they have a very robust industrial base that can build out ships and warplanes, very advanced ones, on their own. It's the Israelis and the U.S. who seem to be really in a corner strategically. And you're right, in terms of the trade, remember last year, last year, Trump defied all expectations and went to Saudi Arabia and did these incredible trade deals. I mean, really, I was writing at the time that Trump was completely, remaking the world system for the better. And then you could build off of that was the Abraham Accords from his first term. He has basically, with this war, he has destroyed both of those policy sets. There's no going back to that now because we're so sucked in. So it is the collapse at our own hand. And I think it was unintentional. I don't think it was 5D chess. It's the collapse by our own hand of a system that we spent about 70 years building in the Middle East.
Yeah, well, it may not have been intentional from Trump's point of view, but I have a hard time believing that they didn't know that the strait being closed would cause the fertilizer shortage. I mean, it seems to me like all of the negative, unforeseen consequences of this are very much in line with what we know the globalists have wanted for a while, right?
Yeah, well, this gets to my buddy Michael Yan, you know, who's been warning me for 5 years that the Giga famine was coming. It was just a question of what was going to trip the thing off. Certainly, there is a sect of elites who, for various reasons, want to create artificial shortages. We saw that play out a bit in COVID. It wasn't as severe, believe it or not, as it could have been. And so this group might be getting a second shot at the second chance here to do the shortage scheme that they want. It's definitely, though, a group of very powerful interlocking interests behind the scenes who actually are happy with the shortages. I will say, though, I don't think the president understood what he was doing. I think the president believed this was going to be Venezuela 2.0. I think that the Netanyahu was blowing him up saying, oh, 96 hours, you kill the Ayatollah and those IRGC guys and they'll collapse like a house of cards like Maduro did. And I think Trump believed him. But I do know that our generals, General Kane, I know this was revealed in that Reuters report right before the war began. The Joint Chiefs of Staff did tell him, Mr. President, this is not Venezuela, and they said that the Iranians could very well shut down the strait, which will then have all these knock-on effects. But Trump, being Trump, can't hear negative news. You know, he can't listen to anything negative. He's like a classic boomer. Everything's got to be on the up and up always. And so he acted in contravention to the best military advice he was given.
And, you know, Alex talked about this a lot, I think, on his Monday show. I think it might have been with Michael Yan. And sort of comparing Trump's current geopolitical behavior to Adolf Hitler. And that's what I think of when I, you know, that was Hitler's impression of Russia,
that's
right?
It's a very Michael Yan thing. Yeah.
Well, but you know, you go, hey, Russia's so weak. All we have to do is kick in the door, right? There's some quote from Hitler of
100%.
It's a shaky house. You kick in the door,
Napoleon,
collapses.
By the way, Napoleon thought this too about the Russians. This is a common, you know, you make these assumptions based on, you know, things unrelated. And I don't mean to cut you off, but yes, it's not just Hitler. It's Napoleon, and there's several other. I mean, everybody should look up Crassus, the great Roman general who believed he could easily take out the Persian Empire, and he ended up paying the ultimate price for that assumption. So, this is great history replaying.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah, he was captured, right? And
captured and paraded, and I believe they ultimately killed him.
Yeah,
but not before humiliating him.
Yeah. Richest man in the world, one of the triumvirates, right? Or maybe
I think that's right. I think that's right.
It's just amazing the way history repeats like this, that it's in the same area. It's Persia and it's the new Rome.
You don't think it would happen, right? You don't think it would happen in the United States, because anybody who's aware of our founding realizes how hard the founders worked to make us unlike the rest of the world.
Right.
We have our own Crassus in Trump.
and then,
this very Romanesque figure in his own right.
God, and just to add to the dimension of the Hitler similarities, you know, one of the reasons Hitler didn't just march on Moscow is because he had this fear of repeating Napoleon's mistake, right?
Yes.
And so he was like, we're not doing what Napoleon did. We're not making that mistake.
Yeah.
And now I'm looking at Trump going, hey, I'm not George W. Bush. I'm not going to make his mistake.
Right.
No, you're going to make all your own mistakes, sir. It's going to be all on your
all
own.
All new ones.
Wow.
That's right. And that's really where we are right now is you have these epic level disasters forming. There it is.
Yep.
There we go. You have these epic level disasters forming that kind of repeat or rhyme with history that happened before. But, there's no stopping it. All we can do is sort of document. I keep telling people I'm more of an obituarist than I am anything else. I'm just documenting the end because, Harrison, I was out with the Air Force last week at a facility in the Southeast United States, and it was very interesting, the generational divide in the officer corps. You had the boomers and the Gen Xer officers who hated everything I was telling them, and then you had millennial and Gen Z officers, young guys, who were nodding in agreement the whole time when I spoke. There is clearly a not only history repeating, but there's clearly a very serious generational divide with people who are 40 and older and under 40. And I think it's going to define American politics for the next 10 to 20 years.
You know, I was just talking, I just did Alex Stein's show, and he and I did a debate with Owen Schroyer against some boomers. and we were reminiscing about it and going, you know, we got along with the boomers perfectly. We agreed on everything. It was like, this isn't even a debate. What are we even doing here? Until it got to foreign policy. And then suddenly it was like this shocking divide where they were convinced that we'd found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and what we were doing in Iran is you know, imperative. There really is a generational divide specifically with foreign policy. And that's very strange. But it sort of makes sense if you come up in a world where America is the man, the big man on campus. They're the man stomping around, you know, telling everybody what to do. I guess it's just hard to let that go.
Well, it is. And also, I mean, the memory of the Holocaust when it comes to specifically issues related to Israel and the Middle East, I mean, you know, they were closer to it than our generation and the gen. I mean, I'm millennial. So our generation and the Gen Z generation, certainly. So I can empathize with or sympathize with them on some level, being sensitive to it. But at the same time, you can't let that historical event that happened in Europe, by the way, we didn't do it. It was
Europe.
No,
we stopped it, actually.
We stopped it, right? You can't let that historical event, though, be the definition of the entire U.S. position in the Middle East. That's a terrible way to go about things. You need to be much more judicious and responsible.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately, the boomers are not, they're not known for their judiciousness or responsibility. You know, remember, this is the generation of Woodstock. So, I don't know how judicious they are.
Hey, hashtag not all boomers. If you're listening to us boomers, you're the one of the good ones. We love you and we need you on our side. Right. We need the boomer waffen, you know, the troops coming in. but seriously, you know, nothing better than a based boomer. But man, on average, it's really not good. Just quickly, I know we only have 2 minutes left, but like the bombing of Lebanon, what's going on with Lebanon? I mean, the whole thing seems absurd because you've got the government of Lebanon negotiating with the government of Israel when really the combatant is Hezbollah, who's not at the meeting. So like, how does that even work out?
Oh, well, the whole thing is an exercise in stupidity. It is just designed to have a facade of peace. The Israeli government is fully committed. I talked to a very senior retired Israeli guy, IDF general, who was saying their goal is to create a buffer between they're calling it the Gaza model, actually, which I just couldn't believe that they're openly calling it that. But between northern Israel and southern Lebanon. So they don't really care about peace. They're going to do what they're going to do. Again, it's important to remember Hezbollah had reduced its footprint in South Lebanon after the Pagers operation. The force that's fighting there is not the prime Hezbollah force, and yet the Israelis are not winning this fight that they've started. They are barely breaking even. And so that indicates, and in fact, if you look at the way that they're doing these attacks, that they're sending, the Israelis are these Merkava main battle tanks in these very tight convoy of these rows into the city areas where Hezbollah has set up these brilliant kill boxes, and they're just slaughtering the Merkava tanks, the Hezbollah is. And that's partly because the Israeli troops, I think, are not willing to advance on foot unless they see the Israeli tanks advancing ahead of them, which of course is not how you can conduct modern warfare after Ukraine has shown, as Ukraine has shown us.
Well, this has always been the issue. Israel does not do well with, you know, ground operations. They need America. They need American boots on the ground, which is why everything is going topsy-turvy, because despite everything Trump is willing to do, we still haven't put boots on the ground fighting Iran, which is a small blessing we can be thankful for. Brandon Weikert, follow him on X at WeTheBrandonWeikertReport.com. Buy his books, support this man. He's been right about everything so far.
We've been right about the poison shots and raised the main alarm, and right about the open borders, and right about the wars, and right about the entire agenda. That's why the bad guys want us off air. And that's why it's such a revolutionary act when you take the live feed from Real Alex Jones on X or on Rumble at AJN Live. Get the free app for your phone at alexjonesapp.com. When you support us, we are absolutely unstoppable. All of our victories are shared together. It's because of you. Take action now at realalexjones.com and thealexjonesstore.com.
So much work goes into this, and it's all funded by you going to thealexjonesstore.com. So this is a fundraiser time right now. We need to be raising funds because we are launching into the next stage of our, you know, rocket trip. We've shed one booster, and now the new one's firing up, and we need you to fill our tank and give us the fuel to get to that next level. So please do go to thealexjonesstore.com. There is a mega sale going on right now. You're getting 40% off methylene blue tincture, methylene blue caps, Ultra DNA Revival, Shilajit caps and gummies, up to 35% off methylene red tincture, colostrum, and MK Ultra, and you're getting 30% off all apparel, shirts, hats, hoodies, and everything else. You know, what we sell you at thealexjonesstore.com are just like these amazing naturally occurring vitamins, minerals, supplements, just CMOS and Shilajit. It just is like God's gift to humanity. At some point, humanity discovers it, and get it at thealexjonesstore.com.
Do you think I'm going to sell you something that doesn't really work? I always ask people, they never know the answer, even salesmen. I go, who's the best salesman? The best salesman, a smart salesman, goes and finds what is the hottest, best product that's in demand. It sells itself. I promote freedom. I promote liberty. You are insane if you don't get our ultramethylene blue, the very best out there. You're insane if you don't get our methylene red. You're crazy if you don't do bovine colostrum. You're crazy if you don't take these products. They really work and they fund the operation.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle. AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.